Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Let's not make too much of this, but it's entirely possible today was the last day of the American auto industry as we know it. Everybody realizes Detroit's going to need some help turning things around, and when contract talks got underway for real with the union today, there were some signs of hope. That is, until the head of the UAW started talking. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. AngiesList.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 23rd of July. It's a Monday. And it's good to have you with us. Executives at Ford and General Motors made a big deal out of shaking hands with auto union negotiators today. Chrysler did the same thing on Friday, but the truth of the matter is the negotiations between Detroit's Big Three and the UAW have been going on behind the scenes for months. The buzz had been that these would be the most congenial discussions the two sides have ever had. The car companies are in trouble. Union leaders have been clear they understood they'd have to give something back. But UAW head Ron Gettelfinger rocked the boat some this morning. Speaking to reporters, Gettelfinger said, quote, "A strike remains a possibility. That's always an option we have." So we sent Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out whether it's an option the UAW can afford.
Think of it as the pregame show. Union representatives were at the headquarters of GM and Ford today for good-natured ribbing and hearty handshakes for the cameras. An earlier version played out at Chrysler last Friday. Despite the backslapping and smiles, though, the UAW wants you to know this is no love fest. Gettelfinger says he's not in the mood to make concessions to the Big Three. Robert Schultz follows the auto industry for Standard & Poor's.
You know, I think it's safe to say we expect a fair amount of rhetoric all around, over the next couple months.
He says the trick for the UAW would be to find a way to compromise with the Big Three without looking like it's giving in to them. Otherwise, the union risks losing credibility with its members.
There could be progress made on any number of fronts without it being sort of perceived as a concessionary contract per se.
Healthcare benefits is one of the biggest issues on the table. Workers and retirees won't let the union give up any ground there, at least not without a fight. Schultz says one solution could be for the union to make sure retiree healthcare benefits stick around, but in exchange agrees to share the cost. Ohio State historian Kevin Boyle says this kind of cooperation is nothing new. The UAW and the carmakers have always depended on each other.
Their fates are so intimately linked. I mean, the UAW has always done well when the domestic auto industry does well. The UAW suffers when the domestic auto industry suffers. Their fates are absolutely tied together, and everybody knows that.
That means, of course, it's in everybody's best interest to come to a fair agreement. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Think back to Friday afternoon about this time. You might remember us saying the stock markets had had a pretty rough day. Among the flops was the initial public offering of the online travel company Orbitz. It opened and promptly fell 3%, still hasn't regained its IPO price. Well, today it's another internet travel outfit in the news. Last month, Expedia announced a plan to buy back more than 1 million shares of its own stock. Investors like buybacks because they tend to boost the value of the remaining shares. Apparently, the company spoke too soon. Today, Expedia said it will buy back far fewer shares than it originally planned, almost 80% fewer. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports Expedia is the latest victim of a tightening credit market.
Expedia planned to pay for its buyback by borrowing money, a few billion dollars of it. But today, board chairman Barry Diller called the available terms in the debt market simply unacceptable. Analyst Aaron Kessler follows the stock for investment bank Piper Jaffray.
Essentially, their lenders wouldn't give them a loan at the rate that they wanted. Clearly, it's an indication that the market looks to be tightening.
So much so that a major private equity firm is reportedly looking outside the loan market for financing. Cerberus announced a deal today to buy United Rentals for more than $6.5 billion. A report in the Wall Street Journal said Cerberus will mostly avoid bank loans in favor of high-yield bonds and other securities. Mike Hatley is president of Westgate Horizons Advisors. He says banks make money by selling portions of a company's loan to investors. But investors worry that some big companies could collapse under the heavy debt loads they've taken on, and they're turning up their noses at these new loans.
Nobody wants to buy a new issue because all the new issues we just bought 3 weeks ago, they're all trading at 97 cents on the dollar, 98 cents on the dollar, you know, some of them even lower.
Cerberus's deal to buy United Rentals shows there's still life in the leveraged buyout business, but those involved in the deals are proceeding more carefully. Just last week, investors forced Cerberus to accept less favorable loan terms in order to fund its $7.4 billion purchase of Chrysler. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Right after the closing bell this afternoon, the online DVD rental company Netflix reported higher than expected second quarter profits. That suggests it might be holding its own in its brutal fight with rival Blockbuster. But investors might be wondering more about the future now that Netflix has announced another cut in prices for some of its services. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Netflix cut a dollar off the price of its most popular services. You can now rent by mail one DVD at a time for about $9 a month. The company is reacting to pressure from Blockbuster, which has gotten more aggressive about courting online customers. Speaking to Marketplace last December, Steve Swayze with Netflix dismissed one of Blockbuster's promotions as a Hail Mary pass.
The proverbial football play where you throw the ball as far downfield and hope for the best.
Now it appears that pass may have found its mark. Blockbuster has almost doubled its online customers in the last 6 months to about 3 million subscribers. Meanwhile, Netflix, with about 6.7 million customers, actually lost subscribers in the last quarter.
Blockbuster has clearly stolen a lot of Netflix's thunder over the last 6 to 12 months.
That's Derek Brown, an equity research analyst with Cantor Fitzgerald. He says the price war is starting to eat away at Netflix's bottom line.
Netflix is likely taking out quite a bit of its own profit by lowering prices.
But don't expect Netflix to reverse course anytime soon. Analyst James McQueevy with Forrester Research figures Netflix can sustain its low prices for 5 years.
Netflix is hoping that they can maintain momentum as the world goes to digital downloading or video on demand. They'll be able to carry their brand into that future digital world.
Downloading videos has not caught on with the general public yet, and Netflix only offers a limited selection of digital titles. McQueevy says Netflix needs to expand its online library to give customers more options. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Earnings reports like that Netflix number helped boost investors today. So did a couple of big corporate purchases. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Years ago, annual revenue for UPS was just shy of $23 billion. Last year, it was more than double that to $48 billion. So how come? One word. Well, maybe two. Globalization and the Internet. Much of the credit for bringing the 100-year-old delivery company into the modern era goes to its current CEO, a UPS lifer named Mike Eskew.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, a chat I had with Eskew at a distribution facility near the company's Atlanta headquarters. The plant handles upwards of 500,000 of the 15 million parcels UPS moves around the world every day. And so I asked him where the company would be without a truly global economy.
Well, when I think about globalization for this company, I think it gives our customers a great opportunity to go more places and do more things. I mean, if you think about the Internet. The Internet is a metaphor, in my mind, for commerce. It camouflages size. It allows the smallest company anywhere in the world to look like the biggest. You could be in your garage, you can be in your basement, and you've got global reach, and you look on the internet as big as any company in the world. On the other hand, it camouflages our size. It allows us to act small. It allows us to act like that's the only customer we have. And I believe that's the power behind globalization.
What do you say, though, to the people who've lost their jobs because of globalization, who perhaps have seen their personal economic situation suffer at the hands of something that's been really, really good for this company? There's actually a quote I read where you say, you know what, the anecdote is always going to win the day on globalization. You're not going to be able to compete with somebody who says, I lost my job because somebody in China can make this widget for 14 cents.
Well, I do think that those anecdotes are powerful and they're real. And all the statistics in the world won't beat that anecdote. But I do think that we have to think about how can we create opportunities for people without skills and without all the education levels to be able to compete. We have a lot of work to do with globalization. I think we have to inextricably link globalization with the ability to think about those folks that have been disenfranchised, that have lost their jobs, and give those folks a chance to compete in this global world that they're going to live in.
As a guy running a company that is so dependent on free trade and globalization, are you discouraged at all by the lukewarm reception that free trade seems to be getting on Capitol Hill?
I think Congress understands that some of the issues we've just been discussing, that there are those folks that have been disenfranchised, and I think they're concerned about labor standards around the world, and I think we need to find ways to talk about labor standards. It isn't perfect, and unfortunately, you hate to see something I think as good as globalization and good as free trade around the world as a political instrument.
Depending on the statistics you read, UPS carries goods every day valued at plus or minus 7% of the entire economy of the United States. And you are often looked at as a barometer of how the economy is doing. So how's the economy doing?
You know, we said at the end of our previous quarter, which was 3 months ago, that we thought it was pretty strong around the world, not as strong in the U.S. across all those sectors. That's the latest peak we've given to the economy.
You don't want to go any farther
than
that?
No, I think
That actually raises a really good question. Is there a burden that you feel about being so closely watched of an economic indicator?
I don't think so. I think we're not a leading indicator. We're a concurrent indicator. Perhaps 10 years ago, when people would build up their supply chains and inventory levels were a lot heavier, we would see people getting ready for the economy to turn around. Now we think we see it just about in time. If you think about our business, 30 years ago, 2% of the U.S. GDP moved in small package, and today that's about 12%.
Hmm.
And that tells you shipments are becoming more frequent, smaller, more one-to-one, and we think that really is where the world's going.
Is there something you could foresee that would do substantial damage to this company?
If, in fact, we became a very protectionist and very isolationist world, I mean, we really do believe over the long term, globalization, free trade is the best thing for the world and certainly very good for our company. And if that would stop, that would be damaging.
You didn't mention oil and gas. If gas goes to $5 a gallon?
I worry about when gas goes to $5 a gallon, what impact it has on the economy and how much it slows down the economy. We are going to be much more efficient than perhaps people's private fleets, and we're going to continue to find new ways to do it. But when the economy slows down, that concerns me.
Did you ever think about getting rid of the brown?
Never. That's our favorite color. There's a word I don't use, and that's never, but never will we get rid of the brown.
Mike Eskew is the chairman and CEO of UPS. Mr. Eskew, thanks a lot for your time.
Good to be with you.
You can check our website for more of my interview with Mike Eskew and some conversations from some other corner offices, too. It's marketplace.org. The immigration debate may be gone from Capitol Hill, but it's most definitely not forgotten by the people it will affect the most. Most undocumented immigrants in this country are thought to have poor English skills, and they're worried about rumors that when it does come, an immigration bill will require English proficiency, both to fit into society and to get ahead in the workplace. But Jessica Graham reports from Brooklyn, if you want to learn English, you're going to have to go to the end of a very, very long line.
It's Jason Louis Jun's first day of English class.
Work. Everyone.
Work.
Liked.
Liked.
Helped.
Helped.
Today's lesson is the past tense.
Asked.
But Jason is thinking about the future. He's 19 years old and he arrived from Haiti 2 months ago. He wants to learn English quickly so that he can go to medical school.
The country gives you many opportunities. You're supposed to take them because I'm young. I'm supposed to go in the college, but I want to be a doctor.
Just to get a space in his English class, Gislin had to show a lot of determination. He was turned away from 4 language schools because they were full. He finally scored a spot here at Kamba.
Thank you for calling Kamba. How may I help you?
Kamba is a community organization in Flatbush, Brooklyn, that offers 17 free English classes a day. Joe Negron works at the front desk. He spends most of his time telling people classes are full.
Okay, thank you. Our morning and evening sessions are currently closed, because that's how backed up we are.
Negron says it typically takes 3 to 6 months for students to get off the waiting list.
And I don't think I should have a waiting list of 1,000-odd people to come into school and learn English. Not with the money the United States has, especially always advocating learn English, speak only English. All right, well, help them out.
Scenes like this play out in cities across the country. The government spends $570 million a year on adult education. That number hasn't budged in 3 years, but an estimated 11 million adults need to learn English. Anthony Tazzi heads Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Office of Adult Education. He says when federal immigration legislation is finally passed, even more students will crowd New York City's classes.
If we were to have immigration reform enacted on the federal level, which provided additional incentives or requirements for citizenship, I think our programs would be flooded.
Even some of those who want to limit immigration to the United States also want the government to fund more English classes for legal immigrants. They suggest offering tax credits to employers who offer instruction on the job. The problem is that most of these low-wage workers are working for multiple employers with unpredictable schedules and little job security. Take Mariela Leszek. She's from Poland. She recently went to sign up for a class at the Brooklyn Public Library.
Because I would like speaking fluently and perfectly.
But Leszek couldn't find a class to work with her babysitting and house cleaning jobs.
Is possible on a Saturday going?
No. And you work during the day, so you can't go here. And this one's a beginner, so you can't do that. Mm-hmm. This one's too advanced, you can't do that. I don't think that we have a class free.
Tom Patterson coordinates the library's English programs. He often has trouble placing students because they work so many hours.
Immigrants work like crazy, crazy. The schedule just doesn't work with what they have to do in their life. So, I mean, you can tell from her she wants to learn English, but we don't have anything to offer her.
Right. Leszek shrugs and says she'll keep trying to find a class. She heads back to her Brooklyn neighborhood, where she says everyone speaks Polish.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
In New York, I'm Jesse Graham for Marketplace.
Coming up, milk crates go missing and dairies cry foul.
We spent over $4.33 million last year on milk crates, and we can no longer just ignore that and absorb the cost. We have to go out and attempt to reclaim our crates.
But first, let's do the numbers. The stock market seesaw tipped to the upside. Today, the Dow Industrials rose 92 points, two-thirds of 1%, to finish the day at 13,943. NASDAQ added on 2 points, a tenth of 1%, to close at 2690. The S&P 500 gained 7 points, a half percent, wrapped up at 1541. Energy companies moved higher as Transocean and Global Santa Fe agreed to a merger. That raised the prospect of other deals in the oil drilling business. Shares of Transocean rose almost 5.5%. Global Santa Fe stock gained 4.8%. Halliburton, that's the oil services company, their shares advanced more than 3%. Pharmaceutical giant Merck gave a big lift to the Dow. Its shares jumped 6.8% today after the drug maker beat Wall Street expectations for the last quarter, raised its guidance for the rest of the year. Bond prices dropped. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 4.95%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. President Bush hosts King Abdullah of Jordan at the White House. The American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials releases a new report with recommendations on the future of transportation. And after 10 years with no change, the new minimum wage goes into effect. It'll be $5.85 an hour, a 70-cent increase. At that rate, a full-time worker stands to earn about $12,000 a year. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The future of the Wall Street Journal is being decided this afternoon at a Hilton Hotel in downtown Boston. Members of the Bancroft family are being briefed on Rupert Murdoch's bid for Dow Jones. That's the company that owns the Journal. And the Bancrofts own most of the voting stock in Dow Jones, so what they say is what goes. The $5 billion that Murdoch offered was well above where most people value Dow Jones. And given all we've heard lately about newspapers being a struggling business model, how they're suffering at the hands of new media, it also raised a few eyebrows. Commentator and hedge fund manager Cody Willard says, actually, Murdoch's on the right track.
We're constantly learning newer, quicker, and better ways of consuming information and entertainment. So branded, credible content becomes more valuable than ever as the consumer needs a dependable filter for the data onslaught. Superior content defines companies like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And now they can reach a greater audience through more outlets, from PCs to radio and cell phones, with lower costs. Just for starters, the number of people that newspapers can reach is exploding from a few million in the physical world to the 1.5 billion people now online. Clearly, the ability to control the flow of information is dying, but content remains king. That's all the more reason for media companies to keep up their brand credibility. The New York Times and other venerable brands will lace their traditional stories with sponsorships and ads, so they'll be paid every time someone views the content, no matter the outlet. Let's be clear that the revenue generated per each ad from such digital sales is less than the typical revenue generated from, say, taking out a full-page ad in the New York Times. But revenues from such digital sales are essentially full profits, since they require almost no production or distribution. The company's cash flows from its existing businesses funds the content creation already, so repurposing that content for other outlets simply boosts profits. Yes, the market crushed these old-line media companies' valuations over the last few years as it recognized the end of their growth in traditional media. The market has now priced in all the negatives, but none of the potential upside. More content, bigger audience, collapsing distribution costs, and a market that's priced in only the worst? Now that's a business I want to be in.
Cody Willard is a principal at C.L. Willard Capital. That's a hedge fund based in New York City. Tomorrow we'll hear from someone who says, profits aside, something's got to give between new media and old. Tell us what you think about today's commentary or anything else you hear on the program. Our website is marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. We'll be right back. Recycling is good. We can all appreciate that. Anything we can do to cut down on waste is worthwhile. But some kinds of recycling are a good deal less socially acceptable than others. The recycling of stolen milk crates is a multi-million-dollar business. Right, those are the same kind of crates you might have sitting down in your basements. Edmund Woods handles security for the Altadena Dairies here in Los Angeles. Mr. Woods, good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
My reaction this morning when I saw this story on the AP wire was that it was about, you know, just a bunch of college kids stealing milk crates for their dorm rooms. But apparently it is a good deal more than that.
Oh, it's a much bigger deal than that.
What is happening to these crates, and then what eventually are people doing with them?
They are taking the milk crates and sending them to a recycler who regrinds them, and then the regrind is sent overseas to use for other plastic stuff, sent to Korea and to China.
And there's a living to be made in this.
Yes, there is a very good living.
How much of a living? Is there a dollar amount?
Well, you figure that they can get anywhere from 14 cents to 28 cents a pound. Each milk crate weighs approximately 3 pounds. You know, Altadena, we've lost over 1 million crates. Therefore, if you multiply that by 3, then you got 3 million pounds that you can make some nice money at 12 to 28 cents.
Obviously, this is, I suppose it's illegal to steal a crate. I mean, it's marked private property, right?
If you read the side of the crate, there's Penal Code Section 565, Penal Code Section 566. And 566 is a felony to be in possession of a crate for other than milk products.
So do you suppose that there are organizations out there who are actually going out and stealing truckloads worth of these crates and sending them off to be recycled and profiting that way?
I know there is.
How do you know?
Ongoing investigation shows that there are individuals out there who are going behind markets, behind my delivery men, taking the crates and then going to the recyclers. The Dairy Institute has also helped investigate throughout California, and they have found recyclers who are receiving stolen property from people in order to regrind.
Obviously, after you and I talk on the radio here, Mr. Woods, people are going to know it's illegal. But what's your theory on what's going on out there? Do most people who are taking these crates not really think it's illegal? Is it a little bit like shopping carts or something?
Basically, yes. I mean, a lot of people figure, oh, it's no problem. And for years, it was just the price of doing business. But we take out the end, for example, we spent over $4.33 million last year on milk crates. And we can no longer just ignore that and absorb the cost. We have to go out and attempt to reclaim our crates.
So, Mr. Woods, I have one more question for you before I let you go. Let's say, you know, somebody had in his garage, you know, from college days, a couple of milk crates. What might that person want to do with them?
Well, he can contact me at 1-800-457-6688. Let me know he has some milk crates, and I will make arrangements for the crates to be dropped off someplace, or we'll come by and pick them up.
Edmund Woods is the manager of asset protection for Altadena Dairies here in Los Angeles. Mr. Woods, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, your morning pick-me-up is going to start costing you a bit more. Starbucks announced a price hike today, 9 cents on average, about 3% for most drinks. It's effective July 31st, and stop me if you've heard this one before, but the company blames rising fuel and energy prices, as well as increased costs for dairy products. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow jumped 92 points, 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ rose 2 points. That's about 0.1%. The S&P 500 climbed 7 points, 0.5% there. Our producers include Megan Larson, Caitlin Carroll, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, finding the magic formula to less stress and more fun.
To be the person that you want to be, to have the lifestyle that you want to have, you need to learn to manage other people.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.